This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
No less than 70 Canadian experts, academics, and organizations have signed an open letter urging the Prime Minister to defend Canada's digital borders. The letter calls for the federal government to stake out protections for social media, AI, financial transactions, and any data that can be, quote, weaponized by a Trump regime.
Digital sovereignty is the hot digital policy phrase of the moment, driving discussion on Canadian digital policies involving AI, digital infrastructure, privacy, and cultural policy, among others. Yet despite its widespread use, its meaning remains somewhat opaque, as it's often used to frame or reframe long-standing policy positions. The government has begun to flesh out the issue, with the Treasury Board recently releasing a white paper on digital sovereignty that provides a useful starting point for discussion. Here to discuss it and the digital sovereignty debate is Professor Jennifer Pybus, the Canada Research Chair in Data, Democracy, and AI at York University. Professor Pybus's research intersects digital and algorithmic cultures and explores the capture and processing of personal data. Jennifer, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you so much for joining. You know, digital sovereignty is the watchword right now, I think, when it comes to digital policy. I know that I've done several conferences over the last few weeks, actually, and it's almost always framed in this digital sovereignty context. We see the government raising it, although now I've seen the occasional reference to digital resilience, which feels a little more European in the way the approach is taken. And advocates, I think, from all sides on any number of digital policies are now using this framing to support their various policy positions. But when you get that many people engaged in this issue, the meaning around digital sovereignty becomes a bit opaque. And so I think it's really useful to talk a bit about what this means and what some of the real issues are. Why don't we start with your definition? There's a government paper that we're going to come to that spells out how the Canadian government thinks of it, but why don't we start with what you think?
So, I mean, as you said, there are a lot of different kind of definitions and way to frame this. And, you know, from a kind of academic perspective, when you think about digital sovereignty, it refers ultimately to a country's ability to control its own data and infrastructure. And I think in more kind of like plain language, this ultimately means that this is about the ability to exercise control over our own digital lives, over the digital systems that we all kind of come to depend on the data that we collectively produce, and on the infrastructure. This is like another weird word that gets like tossed around all over the place, especially when we talk about AI. On this infrastructure that kind of supports all the processes that allows for that data to kind of move from the ways in which we produce it to ways in which the government needs to use it into different systems to make different kinds of decisions and so on and so forth. So this is ultimately about how do we kind of exercise control over the kind of, you know, how this technology is built, how it's hosted, and how it gets maintained.
Okay. You know, and I think that's pretty consistent with how a lot of people think about it. I mean, it's pretty clear your watchword there is control. I would say, just to be fair, from my perspective, you know, I've been asked about it in a bunch of occasions, most recently at the Canada Internet Governance Forum. And I responded, like, some issues, it's easier to describe what it isn't, at least in my mind, than what it is. And I talked about how I think that some of the efforts to take what I see as older protectionist digital or cultural policies and wrap them up in a digital sovereignty wrapping or package is part of what we see, and I don't think it's that. And I'm also not, and we can get into it a bit more, I'm not wholly convinced that the significant amount of emphasis on infrastructure is at least at the heart of this. I think it can play a role, to be sure, but as I think we'll talk about, there are some important other elements to having control, to use your word. Some people talk about autonomy. I tend to think about it as more a matter of choice and the ability to make some of the policy choices for ourselves. And there is a very significant, I think, legal component where our ability to make some of those sovereign choices may be limited. Now, as I alluded to just a moment ago, the Canadian government through the Treasury Board entered the conversation a little bit as well. Politicians are talking about it, to be sure, but a new paper from the Treasury Board focused specifically on what digital sovereignty means to the government of Canada. I think it's a really useful contribution to the discussion. They highlight, at least from a government services perspective, what some of these issues mean. Can you tell us a bit what how it defines or how the Canadian government is defining digital sovereignty in that context?
Okay, so I actually took some notes waiting for this question. So for the Treasury Board, they define digital sovereignty as, quote, the ability of the government of Canada to exercise autonomy over its digital infrastructure, data, and intellectual property. As you were saying, it's like wanting to have this degree of autonomy, and we'll talk a little bit about why I think that's increasingly important, not just to government of Canada, but for governments like all over the world that are not the United States and not China, and also to exercise power to, quote, make independent decisions about digital assets, regardless of where these technologies are developed, hosted, or supported. And this kind of, I think, starts to kind of get at some of these like real challenges wherein location of where these systems are, where this data is produced, seems to get a bit complicated, whether it's here or elsewhere, comes into these types of discussions.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And as you mentioned, there are any number of different challenges that come up as part of that, location being a big role. The paper itself identifies seven challenges and risks with digital sovereignty, and I thought it'd be useful to walk through some of them. I don't think we have to go through all of them. Readers can take a look for themselves, but there are a few that I think are really worthy of drilling down a little bit. Why don't we start with data, which I know is a focus for you. It's certainly been a focus for me, and I think for many, because I think there's a general perception that the infrastructure itself, of course, is oftentimes running on or using data for the various outputs. Data becomes a central part of what we see from some of the platforms in terms of the services that they have, and the question of whether or not Canadian law applies to it becomes so central. So government does identify data right off the top as really one of its very first things that it thinks about. Can you talk a bit about what it has to say, and of course, curious about some of your thoughts with respect to digital sovereignty and data?
I think that one of the main reasons that this is probably first on the list, because I think it's first on the list for a lot of Canadians as well, just having kind of anxiety of where what how is our data accessed, where is our data actually, where does it actually go when it leaves our devices and whatnot, and how do we exercise some degree of autonomy? And I think that one of the things that we need to like be kind of cognizant of when we're talking about data, on the one hand, this is we can think about it as like binary code and ones and zeros, but this is also fundamentally the digital makeup of our lives. And this is why we have pieces of legislation like PIPEDA, which is there ultimately to try to protect, our privacy and where this data can go. But one of the challenges is that data that, that Canadians produce in Canada through a range of different ways, or that the government is kind of using to make a number of decisions, isn't always processed here in Canada. And when we have the kind of rise of like generative AI systems, this like complicates this even more so. And the other challenge, I think, is that when we start to kind of think about the different kinds of data that's being produced, especially, for example, like health data. So I do a lot of research on health data that Canadians generate through mobile applications. Pieces of legislation like PIPEDA doesn't necessarily protect that and keep that here in Canada. And so when we start to kind of look then at kind of these larger pictures around cloud infrastructures, We have other pieces of legislation that come into contact, which also makes data very important about trying to kind of maintain some sort of sovereignty. And really, I think when I say sovereignty, I mean like how do Canada actually able to kind of have some kind of agency over the data that Canadians are producing, and so they can stay and remain here in Canada. But we have other pieces of legislation, for example, the US Cloud Act, wherein if Canadian data is being processed by American platforms, that potentially means that that data can be easily sent to the US to be looked at for whatever kinds of reasons. And there was recently, like in June 2025, Microsoft went on the record saying that, you know, if the US Cloud Act is invoked, then that ultimately means that that Canadian data that they have access to will be sent to the United States without necessarily consulting or gaining permission from Canadian authorities. So I think that these types of decisions, like June is not that long ago, I think is very much on the mind and probably one of the main reasons why this was one of the first points to look at in that white paper.
Yeah, no, sir. And certainly those Microsoft comments, I think my recollection is that it was they made that reference point to French government, noting that in the context of France, that if there was a conflict of laws, that they would be required to still follow those US laws, such as the Cloud Act, regardless of whether or not the data happened to be located in France. And I think certainly people here in Canada, but frankly, I think people in jurisdictions around the world took a look at that and said, hey, we use Microsoft Cloud too, or could be Amazon Cloud, could be Google Cloud. Regardless, the scenario is basically the same, and presumably the same outcome would arise, such that those companies faced with that potential conflict might well feel that it's forced to disclose it. And I've had earlier episodes on this podcast focusing on the cloud, on the USA Cloud Act, as well as some emphasis on some of that tension with respect to jurisdiction. I think that does highlight, though, that this emphasis on infrastructure doesn't really solve the entirety of the problem. We often talk about saying, let's store that data in Canada, or you talked about processing the data in Canada, which is oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes aligned with storage. But it sounds like that the ability to still essentially guarantee that Canadian law is going to be applicable to that data, even when stored and processed in Canada, is still somewhat limited potentially by that legal conflict that could arise.
Yeah, I mean that's absolutely right. And I think this is a headache that a lot of countries, as like in Europe as well, especially right now, are kind of dealing with, because I think one of the things that people have just kind of fully clocked and realized is that when, you know, before when we used to talk about the cloud, and I just had a class with my graduate students a couple of weeks when we were talking about this, and I asked them, it's like, what does the cloud actually mean to you? And many, you know, quite earnestly said, well, I just have this sort of imagination of this like white fluffy thing in the sky. And, you know, I think that this metaphor is very unhelpful when we start to realize that this is actually a very physical, material thing that comes with hardware. And, you know, now all of a sudden we're kind of locked into a number of debates that are like taking place right now around, by hardware, we mean data centers. So we need a place for all of this like processing to happen, all this compute, as it's being talked about in the media. We need a place to store all of this data. So this is very much a real place. We have chips and semiconductors that are necessary in order to kind of bring those processes to life. Again, very material things. But we also have software, which are then the services that are used, and created through all of this hardware that are kind of layered on top of it. And each of these different components come with places where they're generated. So we have all of these kind of location debates around where the data center is going to be. Can Canada have its own data centers? We have, you know, a number of those coming online right now. Who is going to create these chips? But the chips are now mostly, no, we don't really have any chip creators in Canada, so those will also have to be integrated. And then who is providing, you know, the platform as as a service, so the infrastructure that kind of sits on top that allows people to build on this cloud, which are mainly provided by US-based platforms, whether it's AWS, Microsoft Azure, or Google Cloud. Then we have the infrastructure as a service layer that's built. So this is the kind of compute and storage side of things, right? So these are the virtual servers that are either located outside of Canada, but sometimes they're physically in located inside of Canada. And then, you know, we have kind of some regional Google compute engines, like the one in Montreal. And ultimately, why this matters for Canada is that this underlying infrastructure is still, for the most part, owned by foreign companies, whether they're inside or outside of our borders. And many of these services are located that are located here, as you just said, are still kind of governed by kind of governance strategies that are inside or policies that are inside different countries. So now it's a question of, does it matter if it's here, if it's governed elsewhere? How do we start to kind of think about all of these different layers of this sort of AI pipeline that get kind of compounded and then start to kind of challenge these questions around sovereignty?
Yeah, no, certainly you do a nice job of highlighting just how complex and layered that infrastructure is. I think it's notable that the Canadian government does recognize that there are limits, even just on the more narrow question of data. To quote quickly from the white paper, it notes that using a Canadian supplier or storing data in Canada does not guarantee data will be outside the jurisdiction of foreign courts. The government of Canada can fully maintain legal control only when it delivers services itself or works with providers that operate entirely under Canadian jurisdiction. Now, there are not many companies, there might be mom and pop shops down the street that operate entirely under Canadian jurisdiction, but there certainly isn't anyone that can meet the kind of sophistication and complexity that you just described that operates entirely here. So and of course there are other elements you highlighted, chips. The whole world is clamoring for NVIDIA or AMD chips. We don't do that. We need those chips too. So it raises the question a little bit, is full digital sovereignty the goal here at all? Or are we trying to find some mechanism to, as you started off saying, exercise some amount of control over something? Perhaps that's the data side, perhaps that's some of our legal choices, but doing so in what clearly is going to be an integrated world, because you simply can't, I don't think, really wall yourself off from all of these technologies and services.
No, I agree with you, and I think that the white paper is quite clear about that as well, because it says that, you know, to have that kind of, if we kind of imagine this like perfect space where every single aspect of that pipeline and the kind of AI model stack that kind of sits on top of it is owned by Canada, they will call this like digital autonomy. And they're like, we actually can't achieve digital autonomy because there are so many different kind of components that allow for this to actually work that they don't want to kind of close themselves off of being able to kind of innovate and be able to deliver the services that are being delivered with countries that are trying to bring AI into all these different aspects of everyday life. So their kind of compromise is that is this idea of digital sovereignty, because I think there's like a kind of concern of if every component of that stack of those models that are kind of built on top of those cloud of those data centers of that cloud infrastructure belongs to countries outside of Canada, this starts to create big problems here at home, whether it's for, as the white paper outlines, whether it's for security, this is like a big kind of concern, whether it's for privacy, whether it's for jobs, whether it's for all of these different aspects that matter in society. And so then the question becomes like, how do we actually start to kind of claw back some of that? Because how these investments are only really, and this attention is really only happening now is quite surprising given the history actually that Canada has played within the within artificial intelligence. Like some of the greatest kind of thinkers of this of thinking about AI in the way that it's constituted right now are actually from Canada. So I feel it feels like we're just a little bit behind in trying to get ourselves together.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. People often do reference the leading roles that the Hintons and Bengios and stuff have played on some of these issues, and sort of countered that with a sort of juxtaposition of where we are in terms of some of these other policy issues and legal frameworks. Speaking of legal frameworks, the policy paper obviously references privacy as a second issue in addition, or another issue in addition to data. Its emphasis is more on the Privacy Act, given that this is written from the perspective of the Government of Canada. So that's the public sector privacy legislation that governs what happens when government collects data. But for many PIPEDA, the private sector law is certainly the focal point. Yeah, what are your thoughts? You made reference to PIPEDA earlier as Canada's private sector privacy law. Do you think it is up to the challenge of dealing with these issues?
No, not at all. I think that one PIPEDA was written a long time ago, before any of these, before like AI had kind of come online, and technology had advanced to the way that it's advanced today. So this is one problem. Two, like I think that there's really a lack of understanding about what these technical processes look like, how they actually function, and all of the different workarounds that have been kind of invented by different companies in order to kind of access and move data from one place to another. So this is, I think there's a lot of education that needs to be like thought through, but also I think that we need to kind of think about what AI does and how it challenges existing privacy legislation. On the one hand, we're used to thinking about the extraction of data. So this is sort of, in kind of my world, this idea around surveillance capitalism. How is data kind of, how are we tracked, and how is that kind of turned into different kinds of monetary value? But these systems are not just extracting data, they're producing data. And I think this kind of a very big kind of pressure point for a lot of data protection legislation, because what do you do when data is accessed about one person? But actually, if you take an example, because I look at mobile applications, if we look inside of 99% of mobile applications on everyone's phone in Canada, it's a little third party called Google Firebase Analytics. And its job is to kind of ultimately help developers with profiling for advertising. So Google is not like spying on everybody in Canada with this little third party. But what it's doing is it's accessing everyone's data in Canada, and it's processing this data in order to do a better job at making profiles for that particular developer. So another way to kind of think about this is that when we think about what AI systems do and what is kind of different, is there's this new capacity to process the data of many people, of population level data, in order to understand kind of the one a little bit better. And we see this, like, in the kinds of services that platforms provide, whether it's for Amazon, Government Canada Cloud, whether it's for security measures to help find certain people who are causing problems. There's this kind of new pressure of like needing to kind of look at everyone's data in order to kind of understand the one person's data that much better. So, how that, and then the other problem with that is, how is all of the data protection legislation is written for an individual who is supposed to be responsible to kind of think about this and say, okay, I'm going to be safe if I say yes, or this is okay, so I will kind of proceed. But how do we kind of think about the harms that then come from these systems that might not just impact you as an individual, but actually how your data might be impacting somebody else in a way that you never intended that to happen?
That's interesting. I mean, certainly when you frame it that way, it highlights that I think for many, they feel that there aren't a lot of alternatives. They want to use some of the services you just described. They may find that there are various technologies either embedded within what they're doing or have implications that they didn't necessarily think through. And it raises for me in the context again of this digital sovereignty paper and this question that the element not of whether or not Canada, has the ability to make that choice or control, as you suggested, but questions around alternatives and security and whether or not there really are different choices and alternatives available to us. The government, for example, around security in the paper talks about how government of Canada is dependent on a combination of government managed systems, common enterprise platforms, and commercial technologies, and notes that it's a pretty interconnected environment. It also ref makes reference to what they call a global technology market dependencies. It's sort of a fancy way of saying they're pretty dependent on large global tech platforms for many of these services. I wonder your thoughts on whether or not alternatives to this are realistic or viable. I mean, I mean, of course it can, but should the Canadian government say, we're going off the grid in terms of using these services and sort of do it all itself? Would that make us more secure? Does sort of looking to create Canadian-based alternatives across the stack or up and down the stack lead to other kinds of risks and potential vulnerabilities? What are some of your thoughts?
I mean, I don't think it's really possible. As much as I would like it to be possible, I think what we have to kind of realize is that slowly over time, what's been happening is, especially with all of this pressure that's been put on, whether it's the Canadian government or many other governments, that you need to digitize, we need to kind of be on top of all of our services. And we have this kind of very kind of slow moving kind of tidal wave that's moved with all of these different very large platforms that have kind of evolved. And I think it's really important to kind of think about this, but what we kind of think about is a platform like Google or Amazon. I think as a user, we might just sort of see the interface. So we see Google search, or we see, the store that I go to with Amazon, or if you're Meta, you might see Facebook or Instagram. But actually, like, these platforms are as powerful as they are because they're also like huge infrastructural providers for a whole range of different services. And this is creating different kinds of dependencies by different actors, whether it's I look at mobile applications, and if you're a developer, you can't make a mobile application unless you use a third party to kind of create it or monetize, which is for the most part Google, Meta, Amazon, and Microsoft. If you're the Canadian government, you need to have cloud services to run the government. And who is like the person who is providing that? Well, it's for the most part, it's Amazon, it's Amazon's cloud service or Microsoft Azure for most of the software that's inside all the computers. If you're a farmer, similarly, you're going to have a lot of infrastructure that's like provided by these platforms as well. And there's lots of different kind of research that's out there that kind of shows how this is like so integral. So I think the kind of bigger question is like, how do you kind of extract yourself from these dependencies that have kind of grown up and become so normalized over the last 10 years to create something different? And I mean, there is some attempt to do that. Like, if we look at some of the cloud, like some of the data centers, there are some like independent players. If we look at some of the models that people are developing that want to be used in Canada, there are some independent players. So it's not impossible, but I think we have to kind of deal with the elephant in the room that there's so much dependency that's kind of grown and been placed on these platforms that there needs to be a strategy to figure out how to extract ourselves from that first before we can have this conversation.
Okay, it's that then begs the question of the how. The government, in its paper, identifies a number of next steps and measures that it thinks it can seek to address. What do you see as some of the next steps? I mean, it's clear a lot of people like these services and are reliant on these services. Although I think many would say, hey, it would be good if we had more choices and we could make the choice of whether or not we want to continue to use some of these services or are looking for either homegrown alternatives or just alternatives altogether to create a more competitive environment. Do you have thoughts about how we go about achieving it. I think you've done a great job of highlighting just how challenging it's going to be. You know, if someone made you the AI minister, digital innovation minister for the day, what are some of the kinds of things you might think about trying to do?
Yeah, this is, I mean, I wish I had a simple answer because it's hard to say. But I think on the one hand, I agree with the fact that we need to invest in our own infrastructure. Like this should have been done like 10 years ago. It's good that this is happening, and I don't disagree with that step that is being put forward. You know, hopefully this kind of leads to more interesting solutions. I also think that, you know, in looking at this problem, and maybe this is a bit cheeky because I'm just like going back to highlighting more problems, but if we're thinking about solutions, then I think we need to kind of step back and look around at the elephant in the room with all of this development, which is the kind of glaring omission in the white paper about just the sustainability of these technologies. And in Canada right now, for example, the amount of electricity that all of our data centers use right now equates to about 1% of energy that is used by all Canadians. But there are 20 more big, what they call superscalar projects, which are used specifically for artificial intelligence processing, for the compute of artificial intelligence. And once these go online, that's the projected amount of energy that these will use by the end of 2030 is actually projected to be 14% of the energy that we use in Canada. So that's a significant jump just in 5 years. And there's also like challenges around the amount of water these data centers use, which is they say that 1 megawatt of power, and like the biggest ones in Canada will be, I think, 130 megawatts. 1 megawatt of power uses 25.5 million liters of water to cool these, like all of the different servers inside this data center, which is the daily consumption of about 300,000 people. So this is quite a huge resource pull. And when we kind of look at some of the different technologies, even that's being used in China, nobody likes to talk about China, but China is actually quite sustainable compared to the West. Then I think that this also has to be part of the kind of move forward for Canada, is to really put these issues front and center.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting. Certainly, the environmental issues deserve some attention. I actually think, you know, some of the Canadian government arguments in terms of Canada's potential leadership in the space is actually the ability to power some of this kind of infrastructure in a more sustainable fashion, given the ability to establish some of the infrastructure in colder climates within Canada, which actually might result in both repurposing some of the heat generation within the communities, as well as create more better efficiencies. We'll see if that goes forward. That's been a bit of a dream for a long time, actually, but it's becoming more and more relevant, as you suggest. You know, why don't we close with this? I think you've done a really nice job of highlighting some of the challenges and risks and where there are concerns and just the complexity associated with all of this. You know, what has struck me about the debate at times, and then sort of thinking about what the government's put forward, is that this particular paper doesn't have a ton of the hype that we sometimes see around the framing. It takes on some of these issues, I think, a much more realistic sort of approach. It's not trying to push a particular objective here. It's essentially, I don't think, it seems to be saying, you know, we need to think about data, but let's recognize limitations. We need to think about choices, but let's recognize some of the limitations. So it doesn't come with solutions, but it does identify some of the issues. What are some of your thoughts, sort of as a last issue, around this debate that we've been having? Not our individual debate, but more broadly within Canada around digital sovereignty. Do you think some of the framing's been helpful or a hindrance? And do you have thoughts on where the digital sovereignty debate in Canada goes from here?
I think like I actually don't disagree with what you've just said, and I think that to have it kind of put in the way that it's been, I think it's actually quite useful as a document, not just for like kind of practitioners, but also, I mean, certainly like we've actually looked at it in my and talked about it in my graduate class, and students also see kind of clarity. So I think when there's clarity and kind of simplicity in terms of these are the stakes and these are the issues, it makes it easier to kind of I think solve problems. So I'm always a little bit weary, but I think that potentially there's an opportunity with a white paper like this to help us rethink our, alignment potentially with a more kind of US centric approach to what AI is and what it should be, and maybe opens up room for something that's different, that's not just driven by kind of the usual interests. I think in Canada, there's a lot of interesting research and thinkers who are kind of having these conversations. You have in Quebec, you've got people like Jason Lewis, who is leading a really rich research on what Indigenous AI looks like. You have people like Fenwick McKelvey, Concordia, who is also doing really important research within the policy domain as well. So it's like potentially this kind of opens up a new space to kind of think about what does sovereignty mean? What does it mean not just for government but also for Canadians? But I think, regardless, it also highlights, I think, a deep political, or sorry, deep geopolitical anxiety that's kind of being played out right now, where control, as I keep saying, seems to be now being played out on the technological battlefield. So it's kind of redefining where sovereignty, where we should be looking to kind of think about sovereignty, or what Paulo Gerbato calls a kind of fight for a new fight for technological supremacy. So we will see.
Yeah, well, we definitely will see. I mean, it's pretty clear that this issue is going to be with us for a while. And what we really need is, I think, informed debate and discussion around some of these issues. And so I'm grateful for some of the commentary that and work that you've been doing and for taking the time to join me here on the podcast.
Thank you.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at POBox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at LawBitesPod or follow Michael Geist at MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.